calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on over 85 radio stations from coast to coast. Well, not live on all of them, but a few of them tape delay us or run it on the weekends. But in any case, welcome to our program. Plus, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital, Sirius Satellite Radio, on the weekends XM. Welcome to our program. It is the last day of the week, the day that we always start with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the only independent member of Congress. I think of him as America's congressman. He's the longest-serving independent member of the House of Representatives. Seven times he's been reelected. His website, bernie.house.gov and bernie.org is his newest website. And Congressman Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And also let my listeners know that if they want to call, if they have comments, thoughts, concerns, criticisms, suggestions, whatever it may be, our telephone number 1-866-889-8894, coast to coast, and outside the United States 503-248-0620. And if they want to drop into our live chat room, they can go to tomhartman.com and click on the chat button up at the top of the page. Bernie, Katrina, we're still suffering from. In fact, bad news just in the last hour. The levees are giving way in New Orleans, and Parish 9 or District 9 or whatever that district was, one of the most hard hit in the city, is the water's now chest deep. 35-foot wide waterfall over the repaired portion of the levee. And so it's a tough one, and it's going to get worse. And of course, Rita charging in there. And there's some discussion of how to pay for the reconstruction.
Right. As everybody knows, the president went to New Orleans, and he talked about rebuilding that city and the Gulf Coast. And he estimated that the cost might be as high as $200 billion. And I think most Americans understand that we cannot ignore and leave our friends out there hanging, and we've got to come to their rescue, and it's going to be an expensive proposition. The question is, how do you fund it? And what I found to be absolutely outrageous and almost unbelievable is some of the schemes that our Republican friends have come up with in terms of how to raise this $200 billion. And what they are proposing are drastic cutbacks on a number of some of the most important programs that impact the struggling middle class, that impact lower-income people. They're talking about cutbacks in Medicare, cutbacks in Medicaid, cutbacks in education, cutbacks in job creation, you name it, and they want to cut it in order to come up with the money that we need to rebuild the Gulf Coast. Meanwhile, of course, they are still planning on going forward with huge tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country. And they refuse to stand up to the issue of corporate welfare. Let me give you just one example. This disastrous Medicare prescription drug bill that the Republicans passed after keeping the rolls open for 3 hours and passed it by twisting arms in the middle of the night. In that bill, there is a provision which says that the government cannot negotiate to lower prices with the drug companies. You have 43 million people in Medicare. We cannot negotiate with the drug companies to lower prices. We cannot have prescription drug reimportation, which means that we can buy drugs outside of the United States and get world prices rather than the outrageously high prices that the drug companies are selling Americans. If you do those two things, and I believe there's support in the Congress to do it, if the Republican leadership would allow us to do it, you could save hundreds of billions of dollars on that alone. Lower the cost of prescription drugs for all Americans, have a stronger prescription drug Medicare bill for our seniors, and you would come up with the money that you need to rebuild the Gulf Coast. The question is whether the Republican leadership has the guts to stand up to the pharmaceutical industry, which contributes many millions of dollars to them. But it is astounding to me that rather than move in that direction, save hundreds of billions of dollars, come up with a better prescription drug program for seniors, lower the cost of medicine for all Americans. That's one alternative. The other alternative is cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut education, cut job training. And for them, I guess the choice is pretty easy. We cave into the pharmaceutical industry, and we cut back on the needs of middle class and working families. But that's one of the issues that you're going to see being debated very, very strongly in Congress.
Bernie, we're talking about a couple hundred billion dollars, worst-case scenario in all probability. And E.J. Dion, in, I believe it's the Washington Post today, says, and I quote, "The cost of this year alone, just this year, 2005, of the Bush tax cuts enacted in 2001 and 2003 comes to $225 billion.
Right. Well, it is absolutely incredible. And, you know, we have talked before, Tom, that what these guys really want to do, and they're well on the way to doing it, is to run up a huge deficit, run up a huge national debt, which is now, by the way, $8 trillion. Every person who is listening to this program, every man, woman, and child owes approximately $27,000 as part of that national debt. What they want to do is run it as high as they can. They want to give huge tax breaks to the wealthy and to large corporations. And then they're going to go before the American people and say, gee, there is just no money available for health care, for education, for all of the services that the American people have come to expect. I mean, among many other things in their proposals about how they can come up with money for Katrina was completely eliminating federal funding for public television. So what these guys are doing, as they always do, is use a crisis to go after programs for the middle class and working families. That's part of their long-term agenda. And then at the same time, with no embarrassment, they say, oh, yeah, I guess we can eliminate the inheritance tax, which will cost us $1 trillion over the next 20 years, all of which goes to the wealthiest 2%, half of which goes to the richest 0.1%. So what you're seeing is a war against the middle class, a war against working families, low-income people, and huge amounts of tax breaks and subsidies to go to the wealthiest people in this country. And meanwhile, there are studies that keep coming out. The Census Bureau came out with a study, didn't get a lot of press not so long ago, pointing out that despite the fact that the American people are working harder, real annual incomes continue to decline. Poverty continues to go up under Bush. There has been an increase in poverty for the last 4 years. Over 5 million more Americans are poor since Bush came to office. So that's what's going on. Poverty increases, middle class shrinks, rich get richer, and the government works all of the time to help large corporations and the wealthiest people in this country.
At the same time, the Census Bureau has come out with a study.
Yeah.
You want to tell us?
Well, what the Census Bureau study tells us is that since 2000, since the year 2000, worker output per hour has increased by 15%. In other words, worker productivity is soaring. Yet for men working full-time, their annual incomes declined 2.3% in 2004. The decrease was the largest one-year decline in 14 years for women. Women also saw a decline, but not as severe. So the issue that we do not talk about as a country is why, with technology exploding, worker productivity increasing, why is it that the middle class is shrinking, real income is going down, poverty is increasing, gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider? Those are the issues, Tom, that have got to be thrown out on the table and discussed, because if we don't talk about those issues, people are going to be saying, hey, nobody is talking about what's really going on in my life. People who are listening to this program have no health insurance, or they're paying more and more for worse and worse health coverage. People can't find a dentist. People can't afford to send their kids to college. People are slipping into poverty. Child care, which is an issue we do not talk about in this country, is a huge national disgrace. Virtually impossible in almost any location in America to find good quality, affordable child care. And we talk about family values, and we treat the littlest among us with contempt. So we have got to keep banging away at what is happening in the middle class and come up with some real solutions, make government respond to the needs of everybody rather than just the big oil companies or the insurance companies or the pharmaceutical industry. Those are the challenges that we face as a nation.
And these are not small challenges.
They're huge challenges, but they are winnable challenges. But it gets back to the point that you and I have discussed over and over and over again, that in order to make government responsive to ordinary people are going to have to be actively involved in the political process, not just once every 4 years or once every 2 years, but 365 days a year. To be an American citizen means to take democracy seriously. To take democracy seriously means to be actively participating.
Well said. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman radio program. The last day of every week, the first hour of our three-hour program, always with Congressman Sanders, and it's always a pleasure. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in, and we will be taking your calls right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave them the old, stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya. He has no strength to lead, yes, this you feared. While soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared. Gave them the old, never yet devil speak. Yes, with folks so windle come. No one could hear the truth above the roar.
Welcome back, my friends.
So your debating was a stinker. They bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. You razzle-dazzled home, and they gave you four more.
Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
Yeah, welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. And 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Gary, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First chance I've opportunity I've had to say hello to Congressman Sanders, who I admire a lot.
Thank you, Gary.
Congressman, I'm a liberal to moderate Democrat. I've called before. Tom has a feeling for, you know, we share probably a lot of philosophy. But anyway, having said that, I could never express like Tom, though, so I must say that, never. But in any event, what you've said just kind of dovetailed what I was thinking. It's a coincidence. The bottom line is we must get out the vote. That's the bottom line, and I appreciate you hearing you say that. Now, I'd like to add to this, if I may. I truly believe that the Democratic Party must, more than ever, we must field a heavyweight candidate. And I believe, and I want your view on this, if I may, I believe, and Tom won't be surprised me saying this, I believe Al Gore not only deserves another shot, I believe he has the experience of foreign policy. He was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for years. He ran a successful economic policy with Bill Clinton. And I think, psychologically speaking, if I may, I think the American people, even the ones who are on the fringes, will believe he deserves another shot. That somehow, some way, he may have been cheated.
Yeah,
I believe
Gary,
Al Gore, Evan Bayh, or Hillary Clinton ticket is the best for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, Gary, if I may, Bernie, before you answer that, just a little news flash here. This Jimmy Carter just spent a year looking into the last elections, you know, with his commission with Jim Baker. And Jimmy Carter just now came out and said, this was on Monday in a news conference, not widely reported, just
There's
said.
There's no doubt in my mind that Al Gore was elected president. He received the most votes nationwide, and in my opinion, he also received the most votes in Florida.
So that's a pretty startling comment.
Well,
so, Bernie, your take on that?
Well, I mean, in terms of what President Carter said, is I think most people who study the issue know that to be the case. I mean, the independent investigations done by the media indicated that almost under most scenarios, in fact, Gore ended up with the most votes in Florida. I don't want to jump into who will be the best Democratic nominee, but this is what I do want to say, which is more important than that. Instead of sitting around arguing whether it should be, you know, Hillary or Gore or Kerry, whoever it might be, what I will tell you is none of those people are going to win unless we do a massive effort to educate, to organize ordinary people, to increase voter turnout, to be knocking on doors all over this country. So I worry about less, to be honest with you, what's going on in the top, than I, although that's extremely important, than what is going on at the grassroots. And the grassroots have got to be mobilized. Working people have got to begin the process of understanding how important the political process is. If you do those things, if working people say everybody in America is entitled to health care, we're not going to send our jobs to China, we're not going to give tax breaks to billionaires. Once you start at the grassroots level, that filters on up, and then your leaders are going to be stronger and bolder, no matter who that candidate might be. So my focus is at the grassroots level, educate, organize, do voter turnout. If we do those things, then the top will take care of itself and we'll win a good victory.
Rick in Grand Rapids, we have a little more than a minute left, Rick.
Well, good Friday to both of you. Bernie, I was doing a little research on the Internet, and I came across something called the Trim Bulletins, which is what the John Birchers, how they rate various members of Congress on constitutional grounds and on fiscally responsible. And you might be surprised to know that they actually ranked you higher on both criteria, that is constitutionality and fiscal responsibility, higher than two West Michigan congressmen here, Vern Ehlers and Pete Hoekstra. Does that surprise you?
Well, not really. I mean, sometimes you see the left and right coming together. I have opposed many sections of the USA Patriot Act. I've opposed our disastrous trade agreements that are costing us millions of decent-paying jobs. I believe in American sovereignty, and I opposed a whole lot of corporate welfare and fought for fiscal responsibility. So I suppose on some of those issues, I get support from the right wing.
Yeah, and those are the areas where really, I mean, the old words conservative and liberal almost don't count. It's really what's best for America.
That's right. And, I mean, you know, to be honest with you, the fight for constitutional rights right now against the Bush administration is to be conservative.
Yeah. Yeah, in the classic sense of the word.
Right.
In the very Goldwater, Dwight Eisenhower sense of the word.
That's right.
Those guys have got to be rolling in their graves with what's going on with these folks. Thank you. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie Day. Congressman Bernie Sanders, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Pamela in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Pamela.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I know you know a lot of this, but if I could just put in a plug. I'm in the solar energy field here in the Northwest, and we are all, as we're all glued to our TVs with this devastation, another storm coming, we need to educate our friends and families about the connection between the largest storms ever and climate change. I just heard this morning that money's going to be cut from that horrible energy bill, that tiny little piece they were going to give to alternative energy, the R&D, I believe. I mean, this, you know, on top of all, already the problems that we are facing with what fossil fuels are doing to this planet. If I could just put in a plug, encourage Bernie to think about renewable energy is the way we have to go. I'm a member of the American Solar Energy Society. We put on a tour the first Saturday of October. It's coming up. I'm so excited to have so many people nationwide involved. People can go out and see solar energy, including Baton Rouge, where there was a home that kept powering all through the storm, feeding neighbors because they had solar panels. People can go out and see this if they go to ACES.org and find out what's going on in your neighborhood. You might be surprised to find out how much is going on. There are 44 states that will have tours this year.
Well, Pam, let me just concur with you. You're absolutely right. The technology is now available for us to make an absolute revolution in energy, move away from fossil fuels, move toward sustainable energy, including solar, including wind. including biomass and so forth. Let me tell you a brief story. I was up last week to a tiny town, Coventry, Vermont, right near the Canadian border. The Washington Electric Co-op will now be producing about a third of its electricity for its members from methane gas produced from a landfill. They're converting trash into electricity. And those are the ideas that we need all over this country. The concept, the belief, the reality that today we are driving cars that get worse mileage per gallon than 20 years ago, when we can get cars that get 70 or 80 miles per hour, is incomprehensible. So Pamela is absolutely right. There is a tremendous future for sustainable energy.
George in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hello, George.
Hey, Mark. And first, I want let me congratulate the voters who have reelected Congressman Sanders 7 times. What a bunch of bright people they are! And I also wanted to comment on something. As I was reading yesterday about the way Bill Frist unloaded an obscene amount of money of his own personal stock from his family-owned hospital corporation, I'm thinking. Seems like all the leaders of our government who were the decision makers, they all seem to be multimillionaires, from George Bush to Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice. So is it realistic to expect that that people who who are multimillionaires are going to have my best interest in mind? I mean, there's nothing wrong about being a multimillionaire. It's just that I feel that their life is just so diametrically opposed and different to middle-class working America. And I just wanted to ask Congressman Sanders, what's the makeup of Congress, of our leaders? Do you have to be a multimillionaire to be a leader in this country?
Boy, George, you asked a very deep and important question. Every member of Congress, the House and the Senate, has to file a personal financial statement. And it's not as specific as, in fact, it should be. They're kind of broad. But I think at the end of the day, what we know is, if my memory is correct, that about 60% of the U.S. Senate are millionaires, and some of them are, of course, extremely wealthy. Many members in the House are also millionaires. And obviously, as I think George just indicated, being wealthy does not mean to say you're going to be a bad senator or be a bad member of Congress. But the reality is that for those people who are extremely wealthy, who don't have to worry about health care, don't have to worry about education, certainly don't have to worry about housing, fly around maybe on their own private jets and so forth, they do lose contact, I think, with the realities facing people who are struggling hard to keep their heads above water economically. And even for those members of Congress or the Senate who are not millionaires, they are increasingly dependent upon big money interests to raise the millions of dollars they need to get elected. So I think George's question is a very important one. It tells us why we need real public funding of elections, real campaign finance reform, and that we need to elect people who come from the ranks, if you like, of ordinary people, know what's going on in the real world, who go home and can really understand what's going on in their communities. But George's point is a very important point, and it indicates what is true is that Congress is very far removed from the needs of ordinary people.
And with that kind of election reform in Maine and Arizona, a lot of just average folks are getting elected now to those statewide offices in those states, if we could just do something like that nationally.
I mean, I could trace for you how almost every piece of legislation that comes to the floor of Congress is bought and paid for by big money interests. And so many important concepts, whether it's solar energy that Pamela just talked about, or raising the minimum wage or changing our trade policy, somehow those real issues that benefit tens of millions of Americans, they just don't make it to the floor of the House.
Rob in Santa Rosa, California. You're on the air with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I was just wondering if anybody's doing anything about stopping United Nations Agenda 21. It's been here since 1992, and the American people haven't been told about it. And it's a pretty ominous thing that's happening to us right now.
What is this, Rob?
Pardon me?
Pardon my asking, but what is Agenda 21?
Agenda 21, well, according to Dr. Kaufman, it's a 40-chapter UN document that reorganizes the world around socialist command and control lines. And they use a top-down approach. It's in every aspect of our government right now. It's right. all around the world. And they use grassroots front groups to bring it up on the local level as if the people really want it.
Okay. Bernie, sounds to me like conspiracy fringe stuff. I'll just say, Bernie, your take?
I'm not familiar with that at all.
Okay, thank you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Wayne in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Wayne.
Hi, Bernie and Tom. I've heard and read that the top 1% own roughly 40% of the wealth of the country, and those are old figures, as I understand it. And when you trace that back, a lot of it came in during Reagan, supply side, tinkle down economics. And clearly, Bush's policies are going to exacerbate that problem. And what I'm wondering, we know the Bush administration likes to hide data about the environment and about the cost of Medicare program, et cetera. Do you think we'll reach a point where, say, the top 1%, when they start owning 60, 70% of the country, where they'll start trying to conceal that data because it's just too blatant to ignore?
Well, I think the truth is, it's not just that they conceal it. The issue of the grossly unfair distribution of wealth and income in America is an issue, Russ, that we hardly ever talk about. There are not many radio stations like Tom's that will be programs that will be talking about that issue. To my mind, the fact that the middle class is shrinking, that the wealthiest 1% own more wealth than the bottom 90%, that the richest 13,000 families in America have more income than do the bottom 20 million. I think those are tremendously important economic statistics that we should be analyzing and debating and understanding their implications. Your question is, will reports like that coming from the census report and other economic reports get less public hearing? Yeah, they may very well. But we have got to keep banging away at those economic realities because they tell us a whole lot about what's going on in the economy. Very often, I'm on the Financial Services Committee, and we hear from the Secretary of the Treasury or HUD guy coming before, oh, the economy is doing really well. Yeah? For whom is it doing well? It's doing well for the very rich. What about for the middle class and the poor? So this is a very secretive administration, no question about it. A lot of important information is not getting out. And, yes, I would guess that in years to come, as the balance, as the inequality in America grows, will we be talking about it less? That may very well be the case.
Randy in Iowa, you're live with Congressman Sanders. Randy?
Oh yes. I'm sorry, Tom. I'm sorry. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hey.
Just to add on a question to that other caller that asked about the millionaire, my question is very taboo. Money. We all work, play, do just about anything for money. Now, the administration, all the administrations that I can remember, they talk about cutting Social Security, cutting, you know, benefits for everybody. Why haven't a question been brought up about if a person made a certain amount of money, they don't get Social Security?
Okay, Randy, I don't agree with that, and I'll tell you why. And in fact, that is something that some of these right-wing guys do talk about. The strength of Social Security for the last 70 years has been its universality. Everybody gets it. We're all in it together. Don't believe that you start taking people off, because then what ends up happening, you take a group off today, 2 years from now, more people come off, you're going to end up in 10 or 20 years with a welfare program for low-income seniors, which will be underfunded. I think the real answer to that is not that you cut certain people off of Social Security, but that you do things like lifting the cap so that wealthier people contribute more into the system so that it remains financially strong for the indefinite future.
Thank you. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Telling the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. Right here all day, every day. We'll be back with Congressman Sanders right after this. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Please, Mr. President, I love my country completely. I signed up to serve, and I think I deserve what I'm seeking. Am I just a photo op to you? A powerful resource to spend? A Thanksgiving stunt for the papers? To a personal end.
And welcome back, my friends. 51 minutes past the hour, 9 minutes before. Tom Hartman here with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Anita in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Anita, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Actually, I think you touched on this earlier while I was on the line, so I'd just like you to comment a little bit further on the progress of campaign funding reform. It sounds like from what Mr. Sanders, the drug companies and other big multinational companies pretty much have the government in their hip pocket. So I'm wondering if it's ever going to change, if it's ever going to be not acceptable for these companies to donate large funds of money to political campaigns.
Well, Anita, I think you hit it right on the head. That is the reality of what's going on in Washington right now. And there are some efforts in Congress from Republicans to try to diminish and roll back even some of the paltry reforms we have made in campaign finance reform. I think, as Tom indicated earlier, my own view is that we're going to bring campaign finance reform in this country, not through what goes on in Congress in Washington, D.C., because the drug industry, the drug companies and the energy companies are just too powerful there, but at the statewide level. And we have seen some good breakthroughs in Arizona, in Maine, even my own state of Vermont. But if people all around the country can start putting pressure on their own governors, on their own legislatures, to say something very simple, big money should not be buying elections. Good ideas is what should prevail. And if we do it at the statewide level, I think it'll be forced to creep up into Washington, D.C. But the power of big money right now is clearly the most serious political problem that we face as a country, and it's one that we have to address. Ultimately, in my view, we need public funding of elections.
Armin in Bradenton, Florida. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hey, Tom. What mileage do you get in town with your little Toyota?
It's a Prius. It's around 41, 42.
Okay, I had a pickup truck, and I finally let it go because I think it's more important in the future, immediately right now, to, get a vehicle that gets all our vehicles we have now are all four cylinders. The least mileage among them is 25, the car I drive daily.
Armin, we're little short on time here. Is there a question for Bernie in there?
Well, yeah. Bernie, these conspiracy nuts that call up, that talk about socialism. Did you notice that they never ever mention corporate fascism from the top down like what we have now?
Well, I think just a couple of things. Your first point about driving cars that get good mileage to the gallon is absolutely correct. And what is really sad is the potential is there right now. Detroit knows how to do that. We can get cars that get 50, 60, 80 miles per gallon. And what is particularly outrageous is that you as a taxpayer have given large sums of money in corporate welfare to Detroit, and we're not seeing the product in order to build more energy efficient cars, and we're not seeing those products yet. So we have a lot of work to do in terms of transforming our entire energy system, not just transportation, but the way we heat our homes and so forth, and the potential is extraordinary. And instead of giving tax breaks and subsidies to ExxonMobil, we should be putting money into wind, into solar, into hydrogen, and we can transform our country and lead the world in an entirely pro-environment direction.
Todd in Rockford, Illinois, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hello?
Todd, you're on the air.
Good morning or good afternoon, Congressman. I'm just wondering if there's, with all the great minds in this world, are there any ideas on the books to build and design some type of device that can turn these hurricanes, not the other direction, but just kind of make them so where they don't inflict all this damage and cost all these billions of dollars to our country?
That's a good question. I just don't know the answer to that. I've not heard of it.
I'll tell you, we had a series of experiments that the federal government did in the 60s and 70s where they seeded hurricanes with potassium iodide, and it didn't work. Every 10 minutes, a hurricane releases the amount of energy equal to about a 10-megaton nuclear bomb, and we just don't have the ability to handle that. John Trucker in Virginia. John, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Yeah, Tom, I love your show. My favorite show is Friday when Bernie's there.
Great.
My question is it worth our while to try to promote or try to go after the city congressmen and senators and all them that get health care paid for life? Plus, they also get a huge pension, which the majority of them, as you stated earlier, are well off to begin with, isn't it? I mean, how much would that actually save if we somehow went after that? And I'll listen off the air.
Well, it's not going to save zillions of dollars, but I think people is involved. If members of Congress, such as myself, have a good, it's not health care for life, it's a good, solid health care program. We got a good, solid pension. If it's good for members of Congress, it should be good for the American people, which tells us that every American should be entitled to health care as a right of citizenship. Right now, our health care system is disintegrating. We spend twice as much per person as any other country on earth. Costs are soaring. We need to have health care not just for members of Congress, but for every single person in this country. We need to fight back against these efforts on the part of corporate America to do away with the pensions that were promised to their workers. We need to strengthen Social Security, not privatize it. But we should, all of that stuff we can do if people are mobilized, organized, and educated. That's what we've got to do.
Mobilize, educate, and I'm sorry?
Organize.
Organize, there you go. Congressman Bernie Sanders, you are so great. Thank you so much for being with us again this week, Bernie. It's great talking with you.
Good to be with you.
And we'll see you again next week. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The True People's Radio. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you in the chat room, which you can drop into by going to tomhartman.com and just click on the live chat link, or I think it just says chat room, up at the very top of the page. There's also a message blog area where you can post messages and, you know, more permanent messages and have discussions with a lot of folks. But in the live chat room is in actual real time. In the chat room, somebody posted a bit of hurricane trivia. Ray DeRay, he posts this. He says, hurricane trivia. According to the 1993 World Almanac, the entire human race used energy at the rate of 1,013 watts in 1990, a rate less than 20% of the power of one hurricane. The entire human race in a year uses 10% of the power that one hurricane generates. That's pretty mind-boggling. And it also demonstrates, I mean, just enormous power of nature. Because a hurricane is really reflecting solar energy. It's solar energy, you know, it's heat energy that's being converted into kinetic energy, into wind energy. And while, you know, it's probably pretty hard to harness the power of a hurricane, you certainly can harness the power of the sun and of the wind and so on. So that, I mean, there is so much potential here, so much potential that we really need to be attending to, in my opinion. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Before we go to the phones, just a couple quick things I wanted to share with you. The EPA wants to lighten corporations' administrative burden at the expense of the government. The new EPA plan from the Bush administration, instead of having companies that spill toxic chemicals into the air, water, or soil, into our world, instead of having them having to report when they spill 500 pounds, which right now is the threshold. If you only spill 499 pounds, you don't have to report it to the EPA. But over 500, you have to report it. They want to raise that to 5,000 pounds. And instead of having to report it once a year, they want these companies to have to report it every other year. Yeah. The Saudi minister, Prince Saud Al-Faisal, this is from the New York Times, the Saudi foreign minister, says he has been warning the Bush administration in recent days that Iraq is hurtling toward disintegration, a development that he said could drag the entire region into war. He said he was so concerned that he was carrying this message, quote, to everyone who will listen, end quote, in the Bush administration. Prince Saud's statements are in stark contrast to the generally upbeat assessments of the White House and the Pentagon. He blamed several American decisions for the slide toward disintegration, though he did not refer to the Bush administration or the Bush family directly. Bush waives Saudi trafficking sanctions. Perhaps the reason why he didn't refer specifically to George W. Bush is that Saudi Arabia is one of 14 countries in the world, out of nearly 200 countries in the world, one of 14 that have been identified as trafficking in women and children as slave labor, and primarily prostitution, but also child sex workers and forced labor. Involuntary. We're talking slave labor. 14 countries in the world identified, Saudi Arabia one of them. And this in the Associated Press, President Bush decided Wednesday to waive any financial sanctions on Saudi Arabia. By the way, over $1 billion has been transferred from Saudi interests to interests associated with the Bush family over the last 30 years. Oh, that not from the Associated Press story. Back to the AP story. Here it is. I'll just read it straight. President Bush decided Wednesday to waive any financial sanctions on Saudi Arabia, Washington's closest Arab ally in the war on terrorism, for failing to do enough to stop the modern-day slave trade in prostitutes, child sex workers, and forced laborers. It's pretty mind-boggling. They say they wrap it up by saying as many as 800,000 people are bought and sold across national borders annually or lured to other countries with false promises of work or other benefits. According to the State Department, most are women and children. So some tough stuff, tough news out there. 1-866-889-8894. Neil in Casper, Wyoming on the line. Hey, Neil, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Say, with Cindy Sheehan and the March on Washington tomorrow,
yes,
I have a suggestion for people. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put my flag outside. I'm going to raise my flag to let people know that I oppose the war and I oppose it as a patriotic stance. And I hope that people who go to Washington or do these marches around the country will wear a flag with them to let the right wing know that we are patriots too.
Well said. And hopefully there'll be many, many flags in attendance in Cindy Sheehan's march, because you're right. We need to take back the symbols, and that's one of them, of our democracy. I find it so ironic that so many of these guys, these right-wingers are wearing flag lapels constantly on their shirts. I gave a talk at a church out in California a year or so ago, and somebody gave me a flag lapel pin, you know, a lapel pin, and said, you ought to wear this. And I looked at the back of it, it said, made in China. So it's like, you know.
I'm sick of being told that because I oppose the war, I'm not patriotic.
No, you're more patriotic, Neil, because you care about the future of this country and about correcting the mistakes we've made. Neil, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. This is Jeff Richardson from America in Solidarity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we just we're putting together this workers' rights movie nights, and we just reviewed one, The Agronomist. It just came out, and it's about Jean-Dominique, the Haitian freedom fighter and
right.
truth teller, who was assassinated in, I believe, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just an incredible movie. I mean, there's subtitles. A lot of it is in Creole and French. But for people who can handle subtitles, it's a tremendous film.
That's great.
Really inspirational.
I'll have to keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, the guy reminded me a lot of you, in fact, how
Uh-oh.
He was able to get the people onto the radio and the issues that really mattered, because the media there, quite like ours, was pretty monolithic.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll share a different fate. Jeff, thanks
yes.
a lot. The Agronomist, the movie. I'll keep an eye out for it. That's a good one. Thank you, Jeff. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to chime in with what you and Bernie Sanders were talking about publicly funded election. It's my big thing that I'm trying to support here in San Diego, and I just want to remind everyone to go to publiccampaign.org, and you can click on your state and find your local people to get active with and get involved with, and if there's not one, you start one yourself.
There you go.
easy, and everyone needs to do it. But do have
and let me add to that. The Green Party across the country has been very, very involved in these sorts of things, and in local clean campaigns and clean campaign issues, and they were very, very involved in Arizona in particular. I don't know firsthand about Maine, but it wouldn't surprise me there as well. And you know, it's a good organization. And join the local Democratic Party or Republican Party if you're so inclined, and start talking about these issues within these political parties as well.
Absolutely. Can I just ask you a quick question?
Sure.
At least I think it's quick. Even though John Roberts has been voted out of committee, now he's going to be on the floor, is there anything we can still do? Is all we can do is just call our congressmen?
And it's particularly important to call a couple of them. It's not your congressmen, your senators.
Oh, senators, okay.
Because the United States House of Representatives does not have a vote on who gets on the Supreme Court. Only the Senate votes on it.
Okay.
And so here in Oregon, for example, I have two senators, Ron Wyden and Gordon Smith. Gordon Smith is a Republican. He's already come out and said he's going to vote in favor of John Roberts. Uh-huh. You know, he loves the fascist vote. Ron Wyden has not yet made up his mind, he says. And so, you know, I've called Ron Wyden's office and said, you know, here's my name, my address, my phone number. I'm a constituent, and please vote against John Roberts. Perhaps more important, or not more important, I mean, it's very important that you call your senator, even the Republicans. I mean, I'll call Gordon's. I called Gordon Smith's office, in fact, on this back before he announced his decision. But also, call Senators Feingold, Leahy, and Cole. These guys have come out, particularly Leahy and Feingold. If you're in Vermont or in Wisconsin, it has 100 times more impact. But even if you're not, it has a lot of impact, particularly with Pat Leahy, who's a committee chairman and thereby represents the whole country, not just his own state of Vermont. Call these folks. And the toll-free number, of course, is 1-877-SOB-USOB or 762-8762. And, in fact, here's a little musical reminder of that, if you'd like. It's
1-877-SOB-USOB. Dial for democracy today.
There you go. Call and let them know that John Roberts should not be confirmed.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Tom.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Amy. Good to hear from you. Lynn in Houston, Texas. Hey, Lynn. Oh, we're down to about a half a minute here. Is it a short one?
Well, my evacuation attempt wasn't.
Oh, my. Oh, you want to tell us a story about what happened trying to get out of Houston?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Can you hold on over the break?
Sure.
Okay, great, because I would like to do that one justice. So let me put you back on hold here, and we'll come back to that. We're operating right now on a hard clock on these breaks, and I just, you know, when the machine says it's time to go, it's time to go. So I do, Jimmy Carter, by the way, if you heard it in the first break, Jimmy Carter has now come out and said, he did it this week in a news conference, said that Al Gore won the 2000 election. Not just nationally. We all know Al Gore got millions of more votes than George W. Bush did in the national election, but in Florida as well. Jimmy Carter now, a president, a former president of the United States, the guy who with James Baker has been, you know, the guy who helped steal the election from Al Gore. The two of them have been studying this thing now for a year and a half, this election commission. Jimmy Carter coming out and saying, no doubt in his mind, Al Gore won the election. President Al Gore. 17 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
There's no other way to say it. We've been lied to and misled into another senseless war. How many thousands must lay dead before we wake up from this nightmare and revive the American dream? If we blindly stay the course, this horse will drown us in the stream. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrow's will depend on what we do today. Don't stay the course on a horse that's going the wrong way.
Yes, indeed, my friends. Don't ever stay the course on a horse that's going the wrong way. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. The Hurricane Rita now, the storm course changed a bit to the east. Looks like I'm looking at the NOAA map right now, current as of about 5 minutes ago. And it looks like just about equidistant between Lake Charles and Galveston, this thing's going to be coming onto land. In those of you familiar with the geography of that part of Texas, That would be right, coming right over Route 124 there, going north up to Route 90 into Jefferson Parish, Chambers County, Liberty County, through that area of Texas and the extreme western end of Louisiana. And Lynn in Houston, Texas, you said you had an evacuation story to share with us.
Oh, yeah. It's more of an epic, actually. A friend of mine is down on the coast. It took her 7 hours to get up to my house on the west side of town Wednesday night, and we left yesterday morning.
You're on the west side of Houston. This map I'm showing shows that the east side of Houston is actually being evacuated.
Yeah, so I'm not in my friend was in a mandatory evacuation. I wasn't. So she came up here, and then when it got up to a Category 5, we decided to leave for Austin. We left at 8 o'clock yesterday morning, and I don't know, you know, for those that know Texas geography, we got to Brenham at about 9 o'clock last night.
What's the distance there between those two cities?
Well, we decided to come home. It took us an hour to get home.
Wow. So that's about 60 miles away.
Yeah, and it took
a half a day.
2.5 hours to get gas, in which we were one of the lucky ones. We were able to get gas and get home. There were many people that were still. What I don't understand is why they didn't take it. You know, in Texas, almost all the freeways have feeder roads, so that they could have just taken all the main lanes and made them all outbound.
Right. Yeah.
And it would have alleviated it some. And I have several friends that tried to get out of town and couldn't.
Yeah, or at least designate one lane on the normally opposite direction way for emergency vehicles that may have to be coming the other way, and keep that separated.
Exactly.
But take the other two lanes and start using the median as well, or the shoulder as well. You know where it works.
Well, we did. We were using the shoulder on 290.
Yeah,
but
okay.
It was just ridiculous. But I got to tell you something. I got my motor silk last week, and I got it in the car Monday.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I think it helped me out a lot because I have a small gas tank. So
good. Well, you know, you never know. Well, hopefully it did. Yeah. Hopefully it
we
did.
Had
it seems like good stuff.
Two cars, six cats, and a teenager.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was quite an awful day, but we're home now, and we're just going to make the best of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wish you well, Lynn, and thank you for calling. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing that story with us. And y'all keep safe, eh?
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Thanks a lot. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, Washington's emptying out, not only because it's the weekend, but also because those politicians who are in the hurricane area wanted to get down there pretty quick.
By the way, let me interrupt you, Victoria. I just want to make sure all our listeners know that you're famous. You were on the, you've been famous all along, but that you were on The Daily Show day before yesterday with Jon Stewart.
I was looking very ugly.
I thought you looked beautiful.
Well, thank you very
much. I thought you looked just great. And, you know, when he did the shot of the press corps there, you were one of the women that he showed. And so, you know, people...
It was very funny. It was really very funny. I did not expect that.
Are you getting a lot of flack from your friends?
Getting a little bit, not an awful lot. It's interesting to, it's a good way of testing who's watching The Daily Show and who's not.
I guess.
Who's hip and who's not.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so I'm sorry. I interrupted you in the middle of an actual news story. Let's go back to that.
President Bush is about to fly to Texas and Colorado later on today. He's going to visit emergency workers and also the U.S. Northern Command headquarters ahead of the hurricane. And he's going to want to show very much that he's in command, not necessarily in control. He can't control a hurricane. But he also wants to get a first-hand look at the preparations, we're told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he shows up and everything has to come to a grinding halt so there can be a good photo op.
Well, that is, of course, a bit of a problem. Now, I don't actually know how long he's going to stay down there. I would certainly predict that he will visit the hurricane area within a day this time. I don't think that he'll be giving a speech on Social Security or playing the guitar in California.
Or eating cake with John McCain.
Oh, is that what he was doing also?
That was, yeah. On Tuesday, he was eating cake with John McCain. On Wednesday, he was playing the guitar. You know, on Thursday... Oh, no, maybe it was Monday and Tuesday were the relative days. And then on Thursday, finally, was the day that his Wednesday night, according to Newsweek, Wednesday night, his advisors drew straws to see who would have the terrible task of giving the bad news. Because he rages. He screams and yells at people. And the one guy having to tell him bad news once, one of these four guys, got the dry heaves for an hour before he did it.
That's so awful.
And so Dan Bartlett got stuck with a job, and he made a DVD of all the newscasts from the previous 3 days of people drowning and, you know, help us, and showed it to him on Air Force One on the way down there. And that's when Bush first learned about it. That was 5 days after the hurricane hit.
Well, I'm glad he's well informed.
Well, you
on,
know.
On top of things.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria, for
Thank
the report
you.
From Washington, D.C. We will talk with you on Monday. I hope you have a great weekend. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Truth and common sense in broadcasting.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, let's get a take on the news and on some of our callers' concerns. Even, you know, what sort of evil is lurking in the hearts of conservatives out there. Is
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
Uh-oh. There you go. Welcome back. Mark Carlin is with us, and David Enders. Mark Carlin is the founder and editor of BuzzFlash.com, and David Enders is a 24-year-old freelance journalist and co-founder of the Baghdad Bulletin, the first post-invasion attempt to set up an English-language news outlet in Iraq. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be back.
Great to have you here. And David, we just got you on the line. At first, I thought you weren't going to be with us, but you're on the line as well. Glad to have you here with us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure, sure. We've got a bunch of callers here. I wanted to bring them in and give you guys a chance to bounce off them as well. But first, just broadly speaking, David, can you give us just a very quick recap of the Baghdad Bulletin and what this post-invasion attempt to set up an English-language newspaper was all about in Iraq?
Well, yeah. I was studying in Beirut and sort of protesting the war when the war broke out. And I was going to go as a journalist. I worked while I was in college for the AP and the New York Times. And a colleague in Beirut who was also working for the English language paper there suggested we sort of do the same thing in Baghdad. There would be some need for it after the war. And he got some funding, and so we gave it a shot.
And what happened?
Well, we ran for 5 months, published 7 issues, and basically just covered sort of very ground level what was happening in the months after the invasion. And eventually it just became sort of too hard to operate something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
We had sort of a half foreign, half Iraqi staff. And
yeah, so you folded up shop.
Kind of,
yeah.
Right. We if we were to believe our own reporting, we didn't want to be hanging around like that very much longer.
And that's a good question, David Enders. You spent a lot of time in Baghdad. What's the situation right now from your point of view?
Well, it's not good. Obviously, we've seen a renewed initiative for attacks in this last week, I guess. And that's sort of, you know, gives you an idea of where we're at. The guerrillas have the capability, essentially, at least in northern and central Iraq, to strike at will, more or less. And it's effective. It locks the city down. it makes it hard for the government to operate. It makes it hard for people to operate, obviously. And this has been the situation now for better than a year. And this is despite, you know, and as well, you've had elections and other sort of supposed milestones, but what people on the ground over there remember and focus on are weeks like these.
Yeah, now
the
New York Times today, right, the New York Times today is reporting that Prince Saud al-Faisal, the Saudi foreign minister, their equivalent of our Secretary of State, says that he has been warning, quote, anyone who will listen, end quote, in the Bush administration, that our actions in Iraq are hurtling toward disintegration and could drag the region into war. You agree with the prince?
That's certainly a potential. Regionally, the actions, have a huge effect. When thinking about the population of Iraq, and even though there's this small 10% foreign jihadi population that came from the surrounding countries, there's that same population within Iraq that would do the same thing if Syria was attacked.
Sure.
And so I think people really don't realize that this is a regional problem.
So there's regional. In other words, you've got people concerned about their family, people concerned about their tribe or clan or larger community, people concerned about their local ethnic group, Sunni, Shia, whatever. People concerned at a nationalistic level about Iraq as a whole, and then people also identifying with all the Arabs or all the Muslims in the region, and at each one of these levels, there's a level of loyalty. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
And opposition to armed forces outside. Interesting. David Enders. Mark Carlin with BuzzFlash.com. Mark, what are you seeing as the biggest stories on BuzzFlash right now? What are the things that are getting the most dings there on your website?
I think corruption, cronyism, and incompetence in the Bush administration. We have an administration, we did an editorial earlier this week, where we basically have the photo ops that Bush does and recently did in New Orleans, Mississippi, and now is doing quote-unquote inspect preparations for the latest hurricane, Hurricane Rita, in Texas. Divorced from the deeds of his administration. We have political reporters now basically conduct theatrical reviews of how Bush does in a photo op, or he does presenting a speech as he did in that rather bizarre talk he gave in Jackson Square in New Orleans, where they brought in electrical generators to the city that had no electricity, turned them on for the speech, including a phalanx of lights to light up the cathedral in Jackson Square, then turned them off and he left. So I think the real issue now is the press going to do as they did with Katrina, concentrate a bit on the actual horrific, disastrous deeds of the Bush administration, or are we going to return to this kind of journalism that judges Bush by the theatrical reviews of how he delivers in a speech and in photo ops?
Did you ever hear the old Fire Sign Theater album, I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus? Where he goes to the future fair and meets the president, Clem? If you haven't heard it, you got to hear it sometime. This was like 15, 20 years ago, at least, maybe 25 years ago.
Well, I think
and it was about
the
Bush presidency. Yeah, it was about the Bush presidency. I mean, it was.
We have a president who has absolutely no accountability for his actions. He kind of skips from puddle jumps from photo op to photo op under Roe's direction and his handed speeches. And then the deeds, the actuality of what happens are never compared to the words. The Iraq War is certainly a fine example of that. We were supposed to have mission accomplished over 2 years ago, and we are now nearly at 2,000 U.S. soldiers dying. And yet the press doesn't compare. They run on two separate tracks. What happens as a result of Bush administration decisions, which are generally disastrous, including the virtual bankruptcy of our country, and then his appearances and how the press rates his appearances run on two completely separate tracks. The only time that I've seen them come together was this brief moment for about 4 days when there was no federal presence in New Orleans and reporters were going places that the federal government said that it could not get to, but reporters could get to.
Right.
And so people were actually seeing real images of misery caused by Bush administration policies. But it does seem that we're starting to return again to we will judge Bush by how he shows up at a command center in Texas to be briefed about hurricane preparations,
right,
as compared to what the actual preparations are.
So we're back to managed news. I mean, they've kicked the reporters out of most of New Orleans and militarized the city, and I'm sure that they're doing the same thing with the entire evacuation area now down, or much of the evacuation area down there. And, okay. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mark and David, let's take a couple calls here and see what people have to say. Colleen in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, Colleen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, first, thank you. I learned so much from your show. And, you know, I know because of the hurricane that, you know, we're not really hearing much information on the war. And Cindy Sheehan, which is kind of what I'm calling about, because here in Coos Bay, Oregon, we're going to join Cindy, with, you know, with the protest to the war. It's going to be at 1 o'clock tomorrow, downtown Coos Bay, on the boardwalk.
Great, and I hope all the folks who are listening to us on KBBR there in Coos Bay get out and participate.
Right, they heard about our peace rally a lot from your show, and we're getting a lot of feedback from that. You know, we're small, but we're doing what you say. We're speaking out and
good on you.
Organizing.
Good on
you. So,
okay, thanks
thank
a lot.
You again. Uh-huh.
Thanks a lot,
bye-bye.
Colleen. Mark, what's your take on the event that's going to happen this weekend in Washington, D.C.? Mark Carlin of BuzzFlash.com.
Well, I hope that once again, Americans rise up as they did in the Vietnam War to say enough is enough. We're seeing one of the most amazing things go on. Bush is saying that we will not be honoring those who have already died unless we continue to have people die. In fact, this was in a Chicago Tribune columnist today, who a woman who has opposed the war, you know, rebutting someone who is giving this theory that a young man is saying he needs to stay in Iraq because his good buddy died and he has to honor his death. So it's no longer any of these myriad, and we certainly had about 20 different reasons that Bush has given us for going into Iraq in successive order. It's now that because almost 2,000 have died, we have to continue to have more dying to honor the 2,000 that have died. It's a disastrous, destructive, circular argument that makes no sense, and I certainly applaud the people that are going to be in Washington this weekend.
Yeah, it's a logic that the last time we heard employed was during the Vietnam War, frankly, and it wasn't quite as explicit as that, although that was the sort of the undercurrent of the you're with us or against us, you know, if you don't like it, love it or leave it, you know, all that whole rant that those of us who are old enough to remember that time remember very well. We're talking with Mark Carlin and David Enders. Mark Carlin, the founder and editor of BuzzFlash.com. David Enders, a 24-year-old journalist who co-founded the Baghdad Bulletin, the first post-invasion attempt to set up an English-language news outlet in Iraq. We'll be back with both of them and your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So if you're a junk bond trader, or you lead us off to war, that don't mean your values are the kind we should deplore. If you break strikes, pollute the earth, run an SNL that fails, your morals still are quite secure. If you were born rich, white, and male, you inherited family values.
Oh my.
Family values. A motto we can all spell, because value ends with E, just like potatoes.
Welcome back, my friend. The old Dan Quayle joke. Welcome back. It's the, 51 minutes past the hour, 9 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. We're talking with Mark Carlin, the founder and editor of BuzzFlash.com, and David Enders, the co-founder of Baghdad Journal, Baghdad Bulletin, rather. And, David, just real quickly, I'm wondering what your take is on the possible impact in Iraq of the big anti-war demonstration this weekend in Washington, D.C., and those similar vigils happening all over the United States.
Right. Well, I think the real impact in Iraq will be whether or not this resonates at the governmental level here in the States. That's
in other words, whether or not it changes our policy.
Sorry?
In other words, whether or not it changes U.S. policies.
Right. I mean, at this point, people in Iraq, I think, you know, they appreciate that a large number of Americans have stood against this. Largely, they're sort of past the point of really caring about symbolic gestures.
Yeah.
And they're looking for action. One thing that I think I'm headed down to Washington later tonight, I think will be really interesting, is to see how the presence of military families is covered.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's really been the backbone of this movement since even before the emergence of Cindy Sheehan, there were vets and families of soldiers who were stationed in Iraq going over there in 2003 and you know, expressing anti-war solidarities with people
right.
actually in Baghdad. And I think that's really what a lot of this movement has come out of in the
yeah.
last year and a half.
So we'll see how it holds together. Tree in Montpelier, Vermont, on the line with a comment or question. Hey, Tree, welcome to the program. Tree, you got to be listening to your telephone, not your radio. Oh, okay, Jerry in St. Louis. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, Tom. I wonder what you guys think of this. You know, I hear these military guys complaining that peace marches lowers the morale of the troops. And I got to thinking that the military in this country is under civilian leadership. The ultimate civilian leadership is we the people. So if we the people get into a debate over the use of our military and that demoralizes the troops, I guess democracy demoralizes the troops.
Yeah, good way of saying it, Jerry. Very good way of saying it. Peter in Oswego, New York. Hey, Peter.
Hey. Yes, I'm a new listener, really enjoying the show. I got a comment and a question. My comment is on the Iraq War. I agree with a lot of the positions that Cindy Sheehan has. However, I don't agree that we need to be pulling out right now. I feel that that would create such a vacuum in there that, you know, it would create a situation not unlike what happened in Afghanistan, which led to the rise of the Taliban. You create that power vacuum. You send a country into civil war.
But what if we've reached the point, Peter, where we have become the problem rather than the solution? What if we're causing more destabilization than we're leading to? Mark Carlin, you see a lot of news stuff flying past BuzzFlash.com. What's the take that you're getting on this? What's the broad consensus, particularly from the international press?
The reality is, as you mentioned, the Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia, if any country in the Arabic world is tied at the hip to the Bush administration, Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabian. Osama was Saudi Arabian. In fact, one would argue, not that I am proposing it, but if we were going to invade any country that was responsible for 9/11, it was Saudi Arabia. The minister of that country is telling Bush that his policies in Iraq are leading to a disaster. The country is held together by baling wire right now. Yesterday or 2 days ago in Basra, the British were forced to get the release of two of their own soldiers who had been arrested, dressed as Arabs with explosives in their car, who had shot at Iraqi police officers. There was a huge crowd of residents of Basra who were revolting against the British presence, in essence, in that city. I don't think we have the allegiance of the Iraqi people. There's something called a constitution there. It's a piece of paper, but the country is in complete chaos. If you read the reports closely, and I'll finish with this, the Americans are basically confined to a very, very few number of places, including the green zone, out of which in Baghdad most people, unless they are fully equipped with the most powerful weapons, don't venture. And so the idea that somehow we are keeping Iraq from chaos is preposterous. Iraq is in chaos.
We have about 30 seconds. David Enders, your take on this? You lived in Iraq. You worked in Iraq?
Yeah, well, I was recently there until August of this year and was down in Basra and saw a lot of what's happening right now building. They're demanding sovereignty.
They want sovereignty. See, what would happen if America pulled out tomorrow morning? Just instant vacuum.
Well, there'd be some serious fighting. There's going to be serious fighting at whatever point we pull out.
So it doesn't matter whether we do it now or whether we do it in 6 months?
We're presiding over the beginnings of it right now.
Over the beginnings of the beginning of the Civil War.
It's begun, but it's building, and we're presiding over the beginning of ethnic cleansing.
Oh, my. Okay. Peter and us, thank you, Peter, for the call. Good to hear from you. Mark Carlin with BuzzFlash.com, David Enders. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And we'll look forward to talking to both of you guys one of these days soon. Do it again. It's our Best of the Rest of the News segment. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be back with more. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. I'm Tom Hartman, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us. Should ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, The conservatives would prefer to call it ANWR. It doesn't have the words wildlife or refuge in it. So, you know, it's better to say ANWR, according to Frank Luntz, than to spell it out. But should the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge be open to oil exploration? And if so, why? Myron Ebell is with us. He is the president of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. A group that is pretty out front in arguing that we should be up there, we should be drilling, we should be bringing the oil down here, and we should be doing it now. Is that, am I accurately stating your position, Myron?
Yes, you are, Tom. Thanks.
And why is that?
Well, I think it's good to have a diversified supply of oil. We shouldn't depend on just, say, the Gulf of Mexico and Texas and Louisiana. We shouldn't just depend on Saudi Arabia. Second, I think it's good to create wealth in this country. This will be producing our own oil, and the jobs and the profits will come to Americans.
This will make billions for ExxonMobil and whatever other oil companies get the leases, won't it?
Right. And they will also pay significant royalties into the federal treasury, so taxpayers will benefit. Third, Prudhoe Bay has been producing since the 1970s. And it's a little west of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge on the north slope of Alaska. And for that oil to come down here, they built one of the technical marvels of the age, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. But as Prudhoe Bay winds down, there will not be enough oil produced to keep the pipeline open, which means the capital loss of a very, very large investment in that pipeline. So I think that's a good idea.
So in other words, use the pipeline. Pump the oil over to the west and bring it down through the pipeline.
Yeah, ANWR is sort of next door, so they'll have to build a little pipeline.
Well, it's about a 700-mile distance between the two, isn't it?
Well, by Alaska standards, that's just a little ways.
Yeah.
We could talk about some other reasons, but I think those are the main reasons.
Okay. Why not? Now, back in the 1970s, we had President Jimmy Carter, who I think we can all, regardless of what you think of his politics, I think we can all agree, was a patriot who loved this country, believed in this country, and did what he thought was the best thing for this country. And President Jimmy Carter suggesting that we should perhaps go in a different direction. This was in 1970, on July 15th, 1979.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Now, all indications that I've seen, I've read several analyses of his proposals, and that we would, in fact, right at this point in time, probably be about, you know, using about 20% less oil. Now, we're talking about, you know, far less than 20% of the oil that the United States uses. And it wouldn't require drilling anywhere. It could birth an entire new industry. I mean, this could be a boom like the computer industry. But when Ronald Reagan came into power, of course, he was heavily financed by the oil industry and, you know, ExxonMobil and whatnot, all these other companies, the Oil Petroleum Institute. And his first official act of office was to pull down the solar collectors off the roof of the White House and undo all this stuff that Carter had said. Why are you advancing the interests of the oil industry over the interests of America?
Well, I at CEI here, we try to advance the interests of consumers, and consumers benefit when markets are free and when governments don't interfere too much to pick winners and losers and skew the playing field.
Okay, can we just talk about that for a minute then?
Sure.
Okay. If consumers win when markets are free and governments don't interfere, then you're suggesting that if there's less regulation, for example, on pharmaceuticals, consumers win, right?
Well, I think that's a loaded question. It depends on what you mean by less regulation. I think that the Food and Drug Administration has killed a lot of people by needless delays in approving new drugs. So yes, in that regard, I think.
But you realize before the creation of the Food and Drug Administration, some of the most widely sold over-the-counter medications in the United States contained either mercury or lead as their primary active ingredient.
I'm not saying I'm against the Food and Drug Administration. I'm saying I think that it's become heavy-handed and cumbersome, and it doesn't do a very good job.
But how do we, in a society, Myron Abel, with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, how do we in a society deal with the predators among us? I mean, I lived for a number of years in Montpelier, Vermont, a small town up in the Northeast,
mm-hmm.
9,000 people. There was a local doctor in town who was drug addicted, and he screwed up a couple of people, you know, surgically. And word spread, nobody would go to him. The guy, he got busted, but if he hadn't got busted, he would have gone bankrupt because
right.
It was a small town. Everybody knew this guy's no good. If there had been a company in town, if there had been a restaurant in town that served bad food, in fact, there actually was. There was a restaurant in town once where word spread that there were cockroaches, and you could go in and see them. And, you know, they started losing business, went out of business. So, you know, in a small community, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. But once you start talking at the level of a larger community, a larger city, or a state, or a nation, how do we prevent the predators from getting us other than combining ourselves together in the form of a representative government and saying, we are going to protect us by our government?
I agree with you. In a large society, you can't, people, in a large city, for instance, a bad doctor won't get found out. That's why we do need things like reviews and regulatory agencies and so on. I'm just saying that regulations do have some benefits, but often they have some real negatives as well. So,
I think you just contradicted yourself.
No. I'm saying that there are regulations that outlive their usefulness. There are attempts, and to go back to the energy situation, there are attempts to skew the choices that consumers make by government, and I think that the energy policies of the 1970s are a great example of that. Let's subsidize and give government grants to all kinds of new sources of energy, and they will become competitive. Well, it's a nice idea, but it didn't work, and in fact...
But look at all the things that came out of government grants and research. I mean, all the Teflon came out of NASA. I mean, there's hundreds of inventions and developments that came out of government work. Look at all the stuff that came out of World War II, for example.
Let's go to energy. Solar power has been subsidized since the 1970s. Reagan may have taken the solar power.
So has oil. Seoul has nuclear.
Hold it. Oil gets a subsidy of tenths of a cent per gallon.
Nuclear is massive, though, and you and I both know it.
Nuclear is
100% subsidy at least.
Well, we don't support those subsidies for nuclear, and we don't support the subsidies for oil and gas and coal, and we don't support the subsidies for solar or wind or anything else. The fact is that solar has had a large subsidy compared to the amount of energy that's produced from solar since the 1970s. So is wind power. They testified in the 1970s before Congress, if you give us a few years of subsidies and incentives by government tax things and so on, we'll become competitive. Well, they're still not competitive, and in fact, the subsidies have been renewed ever since, and they came to Congress with this new energy bill, and they testified, and they said, well, wind power is going to become competitive soon if you just give us a few more years of subsidies. It never has, and it may, I don't know. It seems to me if it ever will become competitive.
In Denmark, they're generating 19% of their electricity with wind power. It's working very well for them.
Do you know how much electricity prices have gone up in Denmark because of that? Do you know that when the new government came in, they said, this is insane, we've got so much wind power, it's going to crash the entire system? and they stopped all new construction.
So the wind was producing so much electricity they didn't need it all?
No, it varies so much. It goes up and it goes down.
Okay, so we have to develop efficient storage systems. So now we're looking at things like pumped hydro or hydrogen.
Well, but you'd also have to spend billions and billions of dollars building transmission lines that can.
But if oil
that
is a finite resource,
what?
Isn't it necessary that we be doing that now?
No, I think we need to be doing that when it becomes competitive. I think there's a lot of experience, but then
you've got a situation where you're going to have a transition point where those who have wealth can make it through fine, but everybody else gets screwed.
Well, no, I think what you're proposing is to screw everybody now. You're proposing let's raise everybody's prices now in the hopes that some of these things work.
Sure.
Well, my feeling about welfare dependency for corporations is that it makes them more and more dependent. It doesn't make them independent and competitive. It makes them more and more dependent upon government handouts.
Okay. So, Myron, we got to wrap it up.
Myron
Abel with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Good point. Myron Abel, CEI.org. Thanks, Myron, for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 16 and a half minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
I'm George W.
Watch it on CD, yeah. And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman program, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. On this beautiful day here at the very end of the week. Richard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Richard, what's up?
In protest to the government.
I'm sorry, I missed your first couple words there. Start over again.
Just a question and a thought.
Okay.
Basically about the American flag.
Sure.
Now, in protest to what's going on in the Bush administration.
Right.
Say if there's an election or a flag day or whatever, I understand that you can fly the flag upside down as a symbol of distress.
Yeah, although, you know, this is taken very seriously. In other words, if you're in theory anyway, if you're flying a flag upside down, what you're saying is somebody call the police or fire department, have them come over. If they can't get into my house, kick in the door because there's something horrible going on inside here. Help.
Well, that's what's happening to our country.
I understand that.
So my suggestion is it would be in protest to fly the flag upside down with a flag of the picture of Bush underneath it. As a protest symbol.
Yeah. I would be, you know, I understand your sentiment, Richard, and don't disagree with the sentiment at all. I am concerned, frankly, when I get postage stamps that have flags on them, I flip them upside down and put them on envelopes. But that's a whole different thing from literally flying a flag from your home upside down. That really is a distress signal. And
okay.
And it could be misinterpreted on the one hand, or it could be construed as disrespect for the flag on the other hand. I don't think either one is going to help you out. You know, I don't think it's going to help your cause.
Okay, that was just one of my questions, and this is why I asked, because I wasn't quite sure of that, but I did think of that,
yeah.
What you're saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, that makes sense. I can agree with it. But sometimes when I think of that, boy, would I love to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
in protest.
Well, yeah, and unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, I was going to say, but there is no, you know, there is no, like, we can't go back to an earlier version of the flag. I know, you know, during the Vietnam War, there was a brief period of time where some of the folks in Students for Democratic Society were playing around with the idea of going back to the Don't Tread on Me flag, you know, from 1774.
Right.
And, in fact, we had one in East Lansing. And, you know, stuff like that, you know, let's try, and of course, there was the, you know, the peace symbol, you know, the kind of Mercedes-Benz
right.
with the extra line in it. But we really don't have an alternative flag, and frankly, I don't think we should at this point. I think it's important to just fly the flag and have a sign saying, I don't support George Bush, or, you know, this war is wrong, or support the troops, bring them home. I mean, if you fly a flag and you put out a sign that puts your political position out, then what you're doing is you're reclaiming the flag.
Okay. Okay.
And that's how I would do it. I'm concerned that flying the flag upside down would be interpreted by many people, including many progressives and liberals, as being either disrespectful or as saying, help, I'm being held a captive in my home. Someone dial 911.
Thought and the question of that. So yeah. I agree with you.
Okay, good. Hey, thanks a lot, Richard. Good to hear from you. Paul in Chicago on the line. Hey, Paul.
Tom, hi. I just had some comments, and maybe you can clarify some things. You had a guest on yesterday named Amy Carson, Moms Against Mercury. Is that correct?
Yeah, momsagainstmercury.org is their website.
And unfortunately, I don't get a chance to listen to your show most of the time in real time, although I agree with 98% of what you're saying. I guess the question I'd like to ask is, at this point, what is your opinion in the relationship between thimerosal and autism?
I frankly don't know. I'm not I don't pretend to be a scientist, or have credentials in that field. I have talked to people on both sides of the argument. I've been following with some interest this spitting match between Robert Kennedy Jr. and the fellow who's been dogging him on the progressive blogs.
Well, can I make a suggestion? I mean,
sure.
I've been listening to you for 6 months, and like I said, I really respect what you're doing, and I've read 5 of your books. I think you're a brilliant person. You have a clear, logical mind. But one of the things that I have not heard on your show so far is a differing opinion on this controversy.
Actually, we had a guest on who was saying Kennedy's wrong.
What I'm suggesting is that that you have an expert in the field. I mean, toxicologist or anyone from the AEP that's talked about this.
I had a physician on who was.
Was he considered an expert?
Yeah, I'd have to go back, but I mean, this is one of the more outspoken people in the field who is not hostile to progressive politics, who's saying it's not mercury that's causing autism, and there is a very very significant debate about that, and
I would say that there in the medical field or in the scientific field there isn't a huge debate about it. It's a very controversial subject, but
right.
If you look at the literature. And if you look at these controlled studies that are being done, unfortunately, there isn't a real causal relationship.
Right. There's like a big lag time, for example, between the time that they pulled the thimerosal out and the time that autism, started increasing and things
right.
like that.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm
familiar with all that, and we have discussed that on this program.
Okay. Well, I just get the impression that it's not very balanced at times. I mean, you've had Amy Carson and David Kirby, and they basically represent, I guess you would call it an extreme view of it.
Yeah,
but,
I understand. And the point that I made with Amy yesterday over and over again was I was not saying this is causing autism. I was saying mercury is a neurotoxin, and nobody is discounting that. The question is, should we be using it or not? Is the downside even worse of having contamination? Those are open questions in my mind. Thanks for the call, Paul. I appreciate it. It is 27 and a half minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
The polar caps are melting at a rapid pace. And rising ocean levels soon could harm the human race. But they have got no proof their theories are correct. Our corporations don't get.
Oh, it feels so good.
Burn another little piece of Brazil, it feels so good.
Cut it!
Cut another little piece of the forest down, baby. No need to worry, cause there's plenty more wood.
Yeah, there's all kinds of wood. 35 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Here on the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. Viagra for your brain, where progressives fiendishly plot total world domination. At least on Fridays. 1-866-889-8894. Jane in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jane, welcome to the program.
Oh,
hi. I had a question about Howard Dean and the demonstration tomorrow. I thought I heard that he was going to be meeting with the Black Caucus, which didn't make any sense to me because Conyers and Cynthia McKinney are going to be speaking. And
this is all.
Like,
are you talking in Seattle locally?
No, I'm sorry. I'm talking Washington, D.C.
In Washington, D.C.?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't know about that. Apparently, I haven't done my homework in that area.
Well, no, that's okay, but I think I heard that really no Democrats were going to be there other than some members of the Black Caucus.
Yeah, now, I had heard that.
And I'm appalled.
Yeah, what we're going to find out. I mean, you know, we'll know by the end of the day Saturday. And on Monday, you know, if no Democrats have showed up for this thing, I'll be very disappointed, and I'll be talking about that on Monday. So.
Well, do you know a way to get a message to the Black Caucus or Howard Dean or something?
Well,
or John Edwards, actually, too.
You mean John Edwards?
Yeah, any of them. I hope someone goes.
Yeah, I don't have a phone number for Howard Dean or John Edwards, although I'm sure if you go to Democrats.org, which is the website for the Democratic Party, that the phone number for the Democratic National Committee is probably on their... I know it's on their website, and
yeah.
You can call and leave a message for Howard Dean.
Yes, I was hoping maybe you might... check up too.
Yeah, well,
in addition to me.
I intend to attend to this as a news story, certainly. And with regard to John Edwards, I think that johnedwards.com is still his website, but I may be wrong on that. But I'm sure if you Google it, you could easily find it. Everybody else, of course, just the 1-877-762-8762 number, 1-877-SOBUSOB, will get you to any member of Congress. That's the switchboard on Capitol Hill, and you
right.
could just start. I would start. You know, right now you've got two senators from Washington who are Democrats. You've got several members of your congressional delegation who are Democrats. So, and I'm not sure who represents you in the district that you're in, but start calling. Call them right now. Pardon?
McDermott.
Yeah. Well, Jim McDermott.
Okay.
He's a good guy, isn't he?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I heard him speak in Seattle 2 years ago. Paul Loeb and I went down, maybe 3 years ago. It was when the big demonstration against the war. It must have been 3 years ago.
You know, but frankly, they're not the leaders of the Democratic Party, if you will.
I understand.
So
but
why I was looking at Dean.
Yeah, but as Bernie Sanders pointed out in the first hour, and he said it so well, and it's so true. Leaders don't really lead. We don't elect leaders in this country. We elect representatives, and we have to be the ones who are leading.
If there's going to be any press, it has to be someone out there that they want to quote. So that's why I was wondering about Howard Dean. But I'll call McDermott's office for sure.
Yeah, give it a shot. Let us know what happens.
Okay.
Give us a call back on Monday. Let us know what
happens.
Okay,
well, thank you for being you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you for being you too, Jay.
Oh,
thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi. I had some good statistics about energy usage of Air Force One and the money, but I'd like to wait till next week on that because I want to address the Alaska wildlife refuge thing.
Yes, Mr. Ebell with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, funded in part with money from the oil industry.
Well, first, the effects of that aren't going to take hold for at least 10 years.
Yeah, it'll be that long before the first drop of oil from Anwar hits us.
Secondly, the last thing you want for national security is pipelines and power lines. Look what happened in L.A. One power line went down. And, millions of people lost power. We have one pipeline coming from Anwar, Prudhoe Bay right now. You blow that up and all you have to do is look at Iraq and see how vulnerable pipelines are. So it doesn't add to national security whatsoever.
Right.
But make us weaker. Other thing is, like with solar energy, during the Reagan administration, we spent many years, like four times, $400 million a year on military brass bands, when we spent only $100 million on solar energy. And we have an immediate source of energy right now. A place like there are a lot of offices, like the Office Max right nearby. They have their lights on 24 hours a day, 380-watt bulbs. They're using 24,000 watts of energy every hour, but they're only open for 12 hours. And so right there, it's 50% waste right there. That's not conservation by turning off. That's just getting rid of blatant waste.
You know, you have to ask yourself the question, why would a business do that when they're paying for their own electricity?
Yeah, and
don't they want to be profitable?
They could raise their profits. They could lower the cost to consumers. This would help consumers. And we would increase the energy.
Jeff, I find it hard to believe that the company is doing that. Now, there is a requirement in most communities that businesses have a certain minimal amount of lighting at night in case there's a fire so that the firemen, when they show up, can see their way around inside. Firefighters can. But, running all the lights, full tilt boogie. Well,
I've quantified. I've measured. There's a lot of stores around here that do that. They in particular, probably the worst.
Yeah, that's very surprising. And, well, that's another argument for at least at the commercial level for increasing the cost of electricity.
And also, that would, you know, if we turn that off, we would have immediate, you know, 50% more energy from just that one effect overnight, right, by just turning off these switches.
Sure.
And we'd have an immediate effect. We could get 20% more energy through just waste reduction overnight. We'd have more money.
Oh,
everything,
yeah,
would be better.
It's one of the amazing things that I came across is that about 7, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, somewhere between 7 and 10% of all the electricity used in American homes now is being used by devices that aren't even turned on.
Yes.
And that is that 15 years ago, we didn't have these things where you plug a transformer into the wall as the power supply, and then it goes to a device where you turn the device on and off, you know, like a laptop computer or speakers or you know, whatever. I mean, there's just all kinds of things like this now. And now we have all of these, all kinds of devices like this where these transformers just sit in the wall sucking up electricity, even though they're not, you know, they're not feeding anything, they're not powering anything. And that's pretty remarkable. And, you know, if we were simply to say put an on-off switch at the electrical outlet, or put the transformer next to the unit, or build it into the unit rather than having it external to the unit, and we could save, you know, millions of watts of electricity.
I put a watt meter on my computer system and have been measuring things. I've been doing a study for about a year now with various computer systems, and I found most computers, when they're supposedly asleep or off, use from 40 to 100, sometimes 200 watts.
Sure.
When no one's even there. So I've been quantifying this for a long time. I'll send you the numbers at some point.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely spot on. And that's why conservation, number one, is the first and most important step, and the easiest step, actually, for us to take as a nation. But it is going to require, in some cases, some government regulation. I mean, if you want to follow Ebel's logic, I mean, you just wait until electricity becomes 70 or 80 or cents a dollar, a kilowatt hour, or a dollar a kilowatt hour, and then, you know, there'll be an incentive to start saving. But that seems kind of silly, because at that point, at the point that the middle class is saying, okay, it's time to save, working poor are wiped out. And that's the problem with market-based solutions, is market-based solutions don't anticipate the needs of everybody. They only anticipate the needs of consumers from basically the median up, not the median down.
Yeah. But looking at all this, we'd have a better economy. It could happen overnight. We'd have better health, and we'd have better national security. And with solar energy, power line goes down, like, you know, the LA thing, people with solar energy, their power's still up. Hurricanes come through, your power's still up.
Yeah.
Solar energy is the best for national security. The only thing is, the only reason solar energy is not really being pushed is because one simple thing: it gets rid of monthly bills.
Yeah. Well, and it gets rid of the centralized ability to control it. And I've been an advocate for a long time. I wrote a chapter for Marianne Williamson's book, Imagine, about specifically about this, about community power, about neighborhood power, about, you know, imagining a future where every community, every 1, 2, 3 city blocks, 10 city blocks would generate their own power and their own heat. And, you know, this is done at the corporate level. It's done at the business level. In some cities, they do this very commonly, but it's definitely not being done at the domestic or consumer level, and it wouldn't take that much organizing to make it happen. Jeff, thanks for the call. You're always thought-provoking, your comments, and always great to hear from you. Dan in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm fine. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Dan?
I'm glad you guys got on the radio here in the daytime. I love your program.
Well, thank you.
I used to listen to you on the weekends up here in Seattle, and now you're in the daytime.
Oh, we're very happy to be there on KTPK.
Yes, I was listening earlier about the gentleman talking about the free markets and the energy, and it all really sounds good on the surface. It always does until you figure the true cost, and you and I probably both deal with true costs. The cost of defending our right to get the oil from the Middle East, how many $100 billion is that a year?
Yeah. Yeah, especially this year.
And let's talk about pollution. I mean, all this oil instead of electricity, how much pollution is this creating?
Well, and particularly the carbon dioxide pollution, we've gone from, you know, 50 years ago, for 10,000 years, literally the Earth being stable at 280 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now our carbon dioxide pollution has raised it up to 380 million parts per parts per million. Excuse me, 380 parts per million. And surprise, that warms up the atmosphere, which even more radically warms up the oceans, which then feeds hurricanes. And so in a very real way, you could say $200 billion to repair Katrina. That's a $200 billion subsidy of the oil, gas, and fossil fuel industry.
You just took my last bullet point, is a lot of people in Katrina are wondering how much stronger that hurricane was for the fact we didn't start.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Dan. Thanks a lot for making the point. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Heard newborn babies wailing like a moaning dove. An old man with broken teeth stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
A whole bunch of folks in southeastern Texas, southwestern Louisiana, concerned very much right now about shelter for the storm. And serious storm surge there. The storm path now, looking at the most recent NOAA, whatever you call them, maps, I guess, projections, they're showing sometime around, sometime between 1 o'clock in the morning and probably around 5 o'clock in the morning Saturday night, or Saturday morning, that would be tonight, late tonight, this thing is going to hit shore. It looks like just about equidistant between Galveston and Lake Charles, and which is causing folks in Houston to breathe a huge sigh of relief. And when you look at the oil production maps, there's a really fascinating part about this. The New York Times has this on their website. This is going right up between some huge refineries in Baytown, in Texas City, in Galveston, in Beaumont, Port Arthur, Lake Charles. But in particular, the ones in Beaumont and Port Arthur. So it's going to be, you know, interesting isn't even the right word. We're going to have to wait and see what this does to oil production in the United States. And, you know, one more reminder that being dependent on fossil fuels, particularly in a very centralized fashion, particularly provided by a very small number of companies, is nuts. It's just plain old flat out nuts. We need to hold self-sufficiency as a high value once more in this country, like we did in the United States after the Great Depression, like we did in the United States for 200 years, actually, for all practical purposes, and kick our addiction not only to fossil fuels, but to the very small consortium of very large companies that provide centralized electricity and power and start decentralizing. Bill in New York City on the line. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I've got an interesting thought about the voting, and I know that more and more people have talked about the fact that they feel that the vote probably could have very well been rigged with the electronic machines. Now, my question is this. What happens now if it turns out that they actually do come up with the proof and find out it was done? Does that mean all of the laws and legislation is going to be reversed?
No.
If so, does that mean now that it makes the crime worth committing, like a suicide bomber, because you become a martyr for the cause, but you advance what your ideal was?
Well, the logic of your latter point escapes me, but
Well, in other words, you commit the crime, you get away with it, they can't undo the legislation that was done,
right.
And now that means you're still stuck with, say, someone like Roberts as a judge, tax reforms that gave money to the wealthy.
Oh, yeah, I think, for example, one of the reasons that I think that Bush is pushing Roberts to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is that that's going to give him absolute immunity from prosecution in the future should the crimes of the Bush administration ever come before the courts. I mean, this is Roberts. Keep in mind, John Roberts is the guy who flew down to Florida during the 2000 election and advised the lawyers about how to file a lawsuit in the Supreme Court. Roberts used to be the clerk for Rehnquist, you know, at that time.
Along with Bolton banging on the door.
Yeah, you had John Bolton, you know, raising hell down there. You had Tom DeLay's entire congressional delegation down there pretending that they were Floridians in trying to intimidate the vote counters, and all of his office staff and his interns, not, or nearly all of them. And you had John Roberts down there with Bush's top lawyers, including James Baker. He was coaching them in how to make a presentation before the Supreme Court in a way that would be meaningful to Judge Justice Rehnquist, who was his former boss. And in my mind, this is political payback. Bush is putting a crony onto the Supreme Court. And I think it's a very bad thing, a very dangerous thing, a very destructive thing. And I encourage people to call 1-877-SOB-USOB. For those who don't have letters on their phones, if you have a cell phone in your car, whatever, it's 1-877-762-8762. And ask for your United States senators. You have two of them, regardless of which state you're from, unless you're in the District of Columbia. Ask for your United States senator, the names of your two senators, and speak with each of them, Republican, Democrat, you know, whatever they may be, and tell them that you feel it's very important that they do everything that they can to oppose the nomination of this right-wing hack.
Well, not only that, though, but then you also have to consider the fact, as you say, since you can't undo it, maybe they should also start considering what they will do if it does come out in ways to undo some of the damage, because as we just stated, it makes the crime worth committing if you just advance your cause.
Well, and that's and I think that the Republicans have been thinking that way for at least since Roe and Bush got into this. Here's Jimmy Carter, a guy who just spent, you know, almost two years examining the vote. And, you know, with the Carter-Baker Commission, and talking about this just this week. And this is something, you know, for some reason it didn't make any of the mainstream press, but here's Jimmy Carter.
There's no doubt in my mind that Al Gore was elected president. He received the most votes nationwide, and in my opinion, he also received the most votes in Florida.
And then he talks about 2004.
The decision was made, as you know, by a 5-4 vote on a highly partisan basis by the U.S. Supreme Court. So I would say in 2000 there was a failure. The year 2004 is hard to grade. You know, I don't have any detailed information about what actually went on in Ohio. If Ohio had gone one way or the other, it would have changed the outcome of the election. And the only thing that I know about Ohio was that there's general consensus that the Secretary of State of Ohio, who was responsible for the administration of the election, was highly partisan in his public approach, and perhaps even in his private administration, but I don't know about that.
That's about as close as a former president can come to saying, you know, they stole two elections in 4 years. And
I agree with you, and that's why I wanted to bring this up as a think tank idea for people who decide there's something we got to do, even if we can prove it later
yeah.
on.
How do we take these people out? Good point. Good point, Bill. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks a lot for being with us this week. Thanks to David Poole for helping produce our program this week, for Louise also for helping produce the program. And thanks to Shelby and Ben for streaming it with RadioPower.org, White Rose Society, the folks at Air America Radio, the folks at Jones Satellite Services getting this thing out, to all of our affiliates all across the United States. Thank you very much for carrying the program. Thanks to our callers. Thanks to the folks in our chat room. You can reach at TomHartman.com. We'll see you all next week. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.